American grassroots political movements are one of the most powerful ways we can make change. That's also true at the workplace. Check out Future Hindsight, a weekly civic engagement podcast for conversation with Jess Kutch of coworker.org. Discover how gig workers can take collective action. Listen to Future Hindsight wherever you get your podcasts. Also, folks, this program sponsored today by SunsetLakeCBD.com, one of our favorite sponsors. I've told you about them in the past. We were all CBD skeptics here. These folks are fans of the show. They contacted me. They're like, try it out. See if you like it. I was skeptical. They're a farm up in Vermont outside of Burlington. They were doing dairy for Ben and Jerry's, and they decided to diversify. They started to grow hemp. It's 100% pesticide free. They only use organic fertilizers. They work with the University of Vermont, one of the top universities in the country in terms of growing CBD. And they are working on implementing regenerative agricultural practices. They have great business practices, $15 a minimum wage for all their employees, or a minimum anyways. Their employees own the majority of the company. And so they sent us a bunch. Matt is the expert on the smokables, but I had tried tinctures before. It didn't really help me. And their tinctures, the 750, the 1500, the 3000 milligrams, is it? Whatever it is. It helps me sleep better. They also have gummy bears that are delicious, full of CBD, help you sleep better. And also for me, the topical salve has been awesome. I've given it as gifts to people. I've gotten responses from listeners about arthritis. I used it on my eczema because you get eczema, you're freaking out, you don't know what to do, you try it, and it worked. I'm not saying the eczema is going to work for you, but I can tell you everybody I've sent it to for their aches and pains have come back with great reviews. Plus, they have coffee that is infused with CBD, Peruvian dark roast coffee infused with CBD. That's my weekend beverage. Matt, give everybody an update on the smokables.
Yeah, the smokables are great. You can stick them right in your grinder. Also, I do like the pre-rolls. It's a nice, non-intoxicant, non-carcinogen smokable that I think is good.
I just gave some smokables, actually, to a friend of mine who is an occasional guest on this program, and he quite enjoyed them. He's not a big pot smoker because he doesn't like to get that paranoid feeling, but he likes to relax, and this thing worked. He was psyched. I was shocked, but he liked it. These guys, like I say, fans of the show, Left is Best is their coupon code. You get 20% off. One word, Left is Best, at sunsetlakecbd.com. We will put the link in our podcast description. And now on with the show.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Tuesday, October 2nd, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Professor Emeritus from UMass, Richard D. Wolf on The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. Meanwhile, Trump returns to the White House as his enablers reap what they sow. Staff hold their breath in fear. And a reminder, the White House still refusing to do any contact tracing from what now everyone considers to be a super spreader event. White House also has overruled FDA's vaccine standards in order to rush a vaccine to market, to the election. CNN poll has Joe Biden up by 16 points in a national lead. 9-point lead in Michigan, up in Wisconsin, up in Pennsylvania, More polling later. The Supreme Court reinstates witness requirement for mail-in ballots in South Carolina because it's not like there's a pandemic going on. Meanwhile, 100,000 already sent ballots were invalidated by Iowa state courts, but just breaking, another judge blocked the Secretary of State from that very order. So 100,000 ballots in Iowa still up in air. Eric Trump deposed in a New York Attorney General fraud case. Meanwhile, the IRS is investigating NRA Chief Wayne LaPierre. Exxon has big plans to make the planet even more uninhabitable. The officer who shot the unarmed Jonathan Price in West Texas, charged now with murder. The subject of that Project Veritas smear claims he was offered a bribe to implicate Ilhan Omar. And congrats, folks. COVID on the rise in 34 states. Alarm bells are ringing. But who's listening? All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the program, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here. Much appreciated. We have a lot to get to today. We have Professor Richard Wolff back on the program. It's been a while since I've spoken to him. Very glad he can make it with us today. Because, you know, we have basically two different problems that are going on that are both concurrent and related. We talk about the failure of this country, the richest country in the nation, to deal with coronavirus in a fairly efficient manner, in one which mitigates the misery and the suffering that inevitably comes with a pandemic. There's no one who believes that if we had a different president or a different government, there'd be no pandemic. But you look to countries, and obviously we can't be like New Zealand, which hasn't had a new case in 25 days. But when we look to places like Canada and Europe, we are we're doing a miserable job at this. And part of it is because we have a system in this country that pre-existed the pandemic that is not suited to serving the American public. And it becomes that much clearer in the case of a pandemic where you have an urgent need to deal with these things, both in terms of healthcare and in terms of keeping people from suffering the economic, I guess, second order effects of a pandemic. And we're going to talk to Professor Wolff about the structural things. And then the other problem, of course, the most obvious one, at least to people, the one that is clear, that is in our face every day, just returned from Walter Reed Hospital. And to be fair, I don't really want to be that fair, but it's not just Donald Trump. I mean, it's the whole Republican Party. Donald Trump doesn't do anything without the enablers in the Republican Party. Here's Donald Trump returning from Walter Reed Hospital. Play the clip first of him ascending the steps of the White House. They want to show that he's healthy, ladies and gentlemen. So instead of going in the back entrance, he walked up the steps. He's going to show everybody that he's healthy. And he gets up to the top of the steps, and here he is. And I don't know if you can see this, but he takes his mask off, of course, because we know how effective that has been. He takes his mask off, and then he basically huffs and puffs for a minute. And then he delivers this, speech. inspiring speech to the American public. Here he is. No sound. There we go.
Just left Walter Reed Medical Center, and it's really something very special. The doctors, the nurses, the first responders, and I learned so much about coronavirus. And one thing that's for certain, don't let it dominate you. Don't be afraid of it. You're going to beat it. We have the best medical equipment. We have the best medicines, all developed recently.
Oh, my God.
And you're going to beat it. I went. I didn't feel so good. And 2 days ago, I could have left 2 days ago. 2 days ago, I felt great, like better than I have in a long time. I said just recently, better than 20 years ago. Don't let it dominate. Don't let it take over your lives. Don't let that happen. We're the greatest country in the world. We're going back. We're going back to work. We're going to be out front. As your leader, I had to do that. I knew there's danger to it, but I had to do it. I stood out front. I led. Oh. Nobody that's a leader would not do what I did. And I know there's a risk, there's a danger, but that's okay. And now I'm better, and maybe I'm immune. I don't know. But don't let it dominate your lives. Get out there. Be careful. We have the best medicines in the world, and it all happened very shortly, and they're all getting approved, and the vaccines are coming momentarily. Thank you very much. And Walter Reed, what a group of people. Thank you very much.
Yeah. God knows how long he was on his back after that. I mean, we have other footage of him, breathing in quite a bit. I'll tell you something. If that guy wasn't the president of the United States, and he was just on, like he was, I don't know, 5 years ago on television selling some product, and he said those things, I think there would be the potential to sue the guy. I mean, go in and tell people, don't be afraid of it. Go out there, wrestle with it. We got the best healthcare. Well, he's got the best healthcare. He's got government-run healthcare.
You're going to beat it as 200 plus thousand people have died.
Right. All you 208,000 people, you guys are suckers. You just didn't try hard enough. The other people still sick from it. You guys are suckers. You didn't try hard enough. Why didn't you go to Walter Reed? Why didn't you have a helicopter fly you to one of the top medical facilities in the world, completely free of charge, have a massive team of doctors, get drugs that aren't available except for on an experimental basis, get shot up with a ton of steroids, and then, you know, we'll see where he is in 3 or 4 days. But that's assuming he recovers. Why don't you do that, American public? I mean, oddly enough, Donald Trump has pointed out a structural problem that we have in this country. In a moment, we're going to come back when we talk to Professor Richard Wolff. He's going to outline that structural problem that that Donald Trump, I think, inadvertently pointed out. You don't have what he has access to, but that's simply a choice that our society makes. Meanwhile, some sponsors, as you know, we're home more than usual these days. Still hard to keep a close eye on things. I don't know, maybe your kids are at home because they're at fully remote school, like mine. Maybe you got to keep an eye on the cats because they're not used to being locked in like they are. Whatever it is, with Ring, you can keep your home safe no matter where you are. And they are on a mission to make neighborhoods safer. Ring's home security products are designed to give you peace of mind around the clock. They give you video doorbells. They can give you cameras that are on the corners of your homes or inside your homes. You can keep an eye on your doorstep. You can speak to delivery people. With outdoor security cameras, you can check on every part of your house. You never miss a moment. They have smart lighting that brightens up blind spots. Make sure you always come home to a brightly lit house. Full home security systems that give you everything you need to protect your family, your pets, your property. For me, there's two things I like about Ring. One, I love the two-way audio. And then I also love, they have outdoor cameras that have solar panels. So you can have them remote. They don't necessarily need to be wired or attached to your house, and they don't rely on batteries, which inevitably run out of power. But they have all sorts of different versions of this. You got to go check it out. Head over to ring.com/majority right now. Check out the multitude of different things. They have stuff, automatic lights that turn on, lights with cameras. You can get a special offer on the Ring Welcome Kit when you go to ring.com/majority. The Welcome Kit includes the Ring Video Doorbell 3 and Chime Pro. It's all you need to start building custom security for your home today. Just go to ring.com/majority. That's ring.com/majority. Also, as you know, it's a good time. There's never not a good time to learn something new, in my opinion. But we got ever-changing routines. People are trying to get back into, like, maybe doing a little bit of exercise. Some people are commuting again. Finding the best way to learn new things can be tricky. My recommendation, Blinkist. It's an app I've talked about a lot on this program. You can work, you can do it on your phone, you can do it on your tablet, you can do it on your web browser. It is unique and it is powerful. It takes the key insights from over 3,000 nonfiction bestsellers. They get 27 categories in which these books fall into, and they condense them down into what they call blinks, which are basically just short snippets you can read or listen to in 15 minutes. Blinkist also is now offering original podcasts from top authors and creative thinkers, or you can also dive deeper into full-length nonfiction audiobooks at a special discounted price. That's fun for Matt. But for me, I'm like the 14 million other people who use Blinkist. I do it to check out stuff. Sometimes it's just books that I feel like I should read, but I don't want to read just to get a notion of what I'm doing, you know, what's out there. And other times it's books that, like, I don't need to read the prose of how to, you know, make friends or something like that. Just give me the 5 bullet points and then I'll go out and make friends. I mean, I don't know if it works for me, but I'll do my best. I mean, that's basically it for me with Blinkist. Is that there are some books that, and for instance, when I interviewed Stuart Stevens, I wanted to know what some of those Lincoln Project people were doing. And I wasn't going to read the whole book, but I read that, I Blinkist the Rick Wilson, Everything Trump Touches Dies. Still very, very apropos. Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker. Another book of, like, basically the how-to, the self-help. I don't need to hear all the in-between stuff. I just want the key takeaways. And I got it in 15 minutes and I listened to it. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer for just our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/majority report. Start your 7-day free trial. Get 25% off of Blinkist premium membership and up to 65% off of audiobooks. Yours to keep forever. Matt loves that. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/majority report. Get 25% off a premium membership and a 7-day free trial, Blinkist.com/majority report. And lastly, you've heard me talk about Brooklinen before. They're home of the internet's favorite sheets. They also happen to be my favorite sheets in my home. Also, I have comforters. And in fact, as I was doing the show, my daughter is texting me, asking me to order her a comforter from Brooklinen and a duvet, apparently. But let me just talk about this today. Brooklinen has fantastic other housewares. And right now I'm looking for anything to mitigate the absolute crap show that we're involved in. So when I get out of the shower, I have a towel that actually just, like, for even like 60 seconds makes me feel like I am in some way just sort of like not where I'm at. Then I'm happy. And their towels are fantastic. They're plush. They're soft, but they're absorbent. They're not too, like, loose. They are firm and soft. I don't know how else to describe that. I know that sounds a little weird. Brooklinen's towels are not only luxurious, but they're reasonably priced. Brooklinen is the perfect place to find all the comforts for your home, including those ultra soft towels. They're so confident in their product that everything comes with a lifetime warranty. Use promo code MAJORITY. You get 10% off your first order at brooklinen.com. That's brooklinen, BROOKLINEN.com. Promo code MAJORITY, brooklinen, everything you need to live your most comfortable life. All of this will be included in our podcast description. You can find the links there or in the YouTube description. Just a reminder, it is your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you get the show free of commercials and in addition also to more stuff, more content at the end of the program. All right. I will, play just a little bit of music and we'll be back with Professor Wolf. Okay, we are back. It is my pleasure to welcome back to the program author of a multitude of books and Professor Emeritus from UMass and his latest, The Sickness of This Is the System When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemic or Itself. Richard Wolf, welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So, Professor, I want to get into this, but I got to start. Let me start with this, which I thought was pretty funny, because there was a piece today in the New York Times. Jerome Powell, as you know, the chair of the Federal Reserve, was sending a message to his fellow policymakers. This was today. He had prepared remarks before the National Association for Business Economics. And he underlined, as he has before, that the economy's resilience owes substantially to strong government support for households and businesses. Now, we can get a little nitpicky about the resilience of this economy. We're already starting to see it being less resilient, as it were. There's a couple of different versions of how non-resilient it is. But I'm just struck by the notion that your argument, in many respects, it's the same argument as the Fed chief is. Now, how we would deploy those resources, the government might be a little bit different because I think you're a little bit more oriented to helping people first, rather than corporations. But let's talk about this because I started the show by saying that we have two sort of, concurrent problems when it comes to COVID. One is the president. But the other pre-existed COVID and made it that much more difficult for us to deal with both the health implications of this and the economic implications of that. That's your argument. Tell us about it.
Well, I think you put your finger right on it. Basically, what I wanted to do was to take the focus we all have on the illness, the sickness, the pandemic, and to say, wait a minute, there's a deeper sickness, a bigger sickness. And indeed, it's what made the virus so deadly in this country that we have an economic system that is sick. And like anything else in life, if one sickness happens on top of another sickness, oh my goodness, you know, everything is multiplied. It's just a tragedy that we're going through. Part of the argument is very foundational. It says, and I know this is sharp, but there's no way around it. Private profit-driven capitalism and the public health don't go together. You have to face that. We have in this country all the factories and offices and stores able to produce adequate quantities and qualities of masks, gloves, ventilators, hospital beds. We can produce what would have been necessary to be prepared for this virus, knowing that we had a catastrophic virus in 1918 in this country, killed 700,000 people, knowing that we've had MERS and SARS and Ebola and all the rest in recent years. We could have been prepared. We should have been. We weren't. We still don't have adequate testing in this country. For example, in our schools, so that the children don't become carriers of this disease, etc. Why don't we? Well, the answer is the private profit system. And let me explain it, because I will do it from the point of view of the businessman or woman. It doesn't pay to produce millions of masks, stick them in warehouses all over the country, make sure they're clean for the next indefinite period of time, monitor those that wear out, that need to be replaced, security for them all. And for what? For a disease that may not come for years. No private capitalist in a capitalist system is going to do it. And the reason has to be stated starkly. What's good for profit and what's good for the public health clash. It's not that the profit system is the best way to do it. It's that the profit system is the worst way to do it, because it contradicts profitability. So that's the first thing we have to face. Capitalism doesn't deliver public health, which ought to be one of the criteria of a system if you're going to live under it.
Okay, I want to expand on this a little bit. I mean, let's define what we're talking about in terms of public health, right? Because we just saw Donald Trump fly to one of the top hospitals in the country, get the best treatment you could possibly get. That exists, right? I mean, and just coincidentally, it also happens to be completely government run. All those people, let's put that aside for a moment, because many people would say, like, you know, the prince of whichever Middle Eastern country will come here for, you know, their cancer treatment. This is not treatment that is available to, I don't know, 99.9% of the American public. So when we talk about public health, just give me a sense of how you define that, just so that we can understand, what our capitalist system is not up to, providing.
I mean by public health, an institutional arrangement whereby a certain minimum basic quality of care is a right of the public. It's called the public's health because it's for the public. It is something understood. Every major university has a department of public health where young people are taught what you need to know to make a population healthy. Give them the vaccinations they need. Give them the vitamin. Give them the regimens in terms of their diet. Provide institutions, we call them clinics, hospitals, where they can go for any emergency, injury, illness, you have it. Be prepared for those kinds of injuries you can foresee. You know, you have a little ambulance next to the football game because people hurt themselves in football, and you are to be prepared. We knew what was needed to be prepared for a virus that can come at any time. We knew what we needed. We knew how to produce it. We didn't do it because it isn't profitable.
Right.
Let me hammer home one more point.
Sure.
You let me. We know even what to do in this case. We don't admit it to ourselves because we are fundamentalist when it comes to capitalism in this society. So we don't admit it, but we do know what I just said. No one is surprised. And we know what has to happen. The government has to step in to compensate for the failure of private capitalism to do what we know needs to be done, namely protect us against viruses, among other things. And the government could have. The government could have done, bought the masks, put them in a warehouse, watched them, stored them, cleaned them, repaired them, whatever was necessary. We know. You know how we know? Because that's what the government does with the military. It doesn't pay anyone to produce a missile or a guided missile or a gun or a ship or a plane or a tank. Do what? Put it in a warehouse? Watch it for an indefinite period of time until maybe a war comes along? No private capitalist would do it. And that's why the government comes in, buys those things as they roll off the assembly line. And then we, the taxpayers, pay the cost of storing it and waiting indefinitely. But what this government did for the military defense, it didn't do for public health. So the government didn't make up for the failure. So here we sit with a failed economic system and a failed government. 4.5% of the people of the world live in the United States, 25% of the COVID cases. It's a failure written in neon over the middle of Times Square.
And I just want to, I mean, this is there. There's a couple of things that I want to just address here. And one is this notion. I mean, the reason why you bring up the military is you're saying, like, you know, the answer is not that our government's not capable of doing this. The answer is simply that we have decided as a society, either consciously or unconsciously, and I want to circle back to that, but I want to put in a pin in it for a moment. We have decided as a body politic, we're just not going to do it. We just don't value making sure that our public health is taken care of as much as we value the ability to launch an assault on another country without having to wait for tanks to roll off or planes to roll off. Yeah. And I just want to circle back to, you know, you use the example of masks and PPE, but also we saw this in the context of hospitals. I mean, in New York State, the moment that we got this under control was when the governor of the state basically, I don't know what the word is when, you know, it's not nationalized because it's just happened in the state, but every hospital in this state, regardless of private or public, came under the purview of the state government. Now, and that was the most obvious, most efficient decision to do because you had resources that needed to be moved from one to another and you needed some type of central coordination for that. We should also note, though, that there is a lot of data that suggests if you lived in a low-income area, you were more likely to die of coronavirus, in part because we had cut back on the public hospital system there, or they didn't have adequate hospitals. That's also on the governor. But that is both those two, decisions, political decisions, illustrate what you're talking about.
Exactly. And not that the Trump administration is the hallmark of all evil. These things we're talking about predate the arrival of Mr. Trump. But he does deserve the credit for making it worse. He tilted more. He gave more money to the military than they even asked for while cutting the budget for the Pandemic Preparations Committee, for the Centers for Disease Control, and so on. He's just part of a tendency to shortchange the public health and at the expense of people. I mean, 200,000 or 210,000 dead people in America, that's a more costly loss than most of the military engagements this country has ever participated in. The disproportion here reflects, you know, when I was young, we used to be told things in our schools that people in Asia, I kid you not, don't value human life the way we do here in the West. I remember going home, repeating this, and having my father get very upset and give me a lecture about why the teacher was wrong. But here's the joke. In terms of how societies are really reacting to this virus, if anything, it looks like the reverse, right? That there's much more care there to shut down the society, to save lives, than we have here. The president saying in a public interview, it is what it is. When in fact it didn't have to be. And then to see that black and brown people are suffering disproportionately, the deaths, the illnesses. I mean, what do you think Black Lives Matters is marching about? It's as if the president is literally instituting a program to show that systematic racism functions when life and death itself are hanging in the balance. For me, that's why I wrote the book, to understand we have a system that is our problem. That's why the COVID is so bad here. And so will be the future problems we have, because this system is systematically breaking down for the majority of the people.
All right. And so we have basically sort of two orders of problems here, too. Let's put Donald Trump aside. I think everybody is sort of hopefully is familiar with his failures. And when you hear our numbers, like you said, 4% of the world's population, 25% of the world's deaths, I want to talk about in a moment other countries and the way that they deal with this, and not just the way that they deal with it now, but what was in place before the pandemic hit, the way their society is organized, the political choices they have made that made them much more resilient when it came to the pandemic. Because I just want to remind people, we have two different, they're not distinct from each other, but they're two sort of silos of issues. And maybe silo is not the right word, because like I say, they're not distinct. We have that the response to the health crisis, which we have failed miserably at. And like you say, in part because of systemic reasons, because it is not profitable to keep all this stuff in, in reserve, and a government needs to step in and do it. And then the other is that our incentive structure in this country is such that it encouraged people to go out and work. States that didn't have funds, it wanted people to open up. I mean, look, everybody wants to go out, but we could all go out and do stuff and not actually have to go to work and subject ourselves to these risks if we made other choices. Talk about start with how other countries were already in a situation to deal with this better than we were. And then about that second order issue where, you know, the fact that there's not proper transportation, that there's a need for people to go into work, to et cetera, have increased, I guess, the virulence of this pandemic.
Sure. There's a lot of ways to do that. Let me pick one that I think gets at it right to the core. In Europe, to take examples of Germany, France, Italy, the Scandinavian countries, so on. In Western Europe, for sure, but in Europe as a whole, a decision was made that the way to handle this virus was by, and let me underscore this, not firing millions of workers. For example, at the beginning in March, unemployment rate in Germany was 5%. Today, it's 6%. No mass increase in unemployment. In Italy, it's even more dramatic. The unemployment rate a year ago, when no one ever heard of the virus, was higher than it is today. In other words, they've lowered their unemployment through the virus. What the United States did is unusual. It is, in fact, and I say this as a professional economist, it is insane. It is crazy behavior. What you need is what the Europeans did. The government there went and it helped the corporations, but there was a condition attached. It was so universal, it didn't even have to be spoken. And the condition was, we, the government, will use the taxpayers' money to help you through this crisis. We will give you enough money to cover 60, 70, 80% of the payroll. But in exchange, you fire nobody. We're not going to allow you to add to the difficulty of people fearful for their illness, fearful for their lives, fearful for what is happening to their society, to be given another problem, namely, you got no job, you've got no guarantee that the job will be there when this is over, or what the conditions would be even if you get the job. We're not going to do that to you. On grounds of human cruelty. So there was no unemployment. Guess what? Since the workers couldn't go to work, or could do so only under limited conditions, but they were still getting paid, they could be given the task of making the workplace safe, move the desks apart, move the cubby holes around, create social distancing, put in the plexiglass screens so we don't breathe on each other, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Here's the contrast with America's capitalism. We fired tens of millions of people. Over 50 million people have had to go to the unemployment office and file a claim to get their unemployment. 50 million people. It's a quarter of our labor force. More than a third of our labor force has had to go through this excruciatingly difficult period. Okay, why? Well, because you couldn't think through all of this. You didn't understand that an unemployed person is not a person who, over the last 6 months, might have been given a good government job. You know, to do what? To test everybody, which we haven't done. To make safe workplaces, which we haven't done. To open the transportation system so it can handle moving people during a virus. I mean, we could have been doing wonderful things, but instead we created a miserable population anxious about their job. I mean, the level of failure here goes way beyond the virus to a system that is really screwed up. And here we sit now doing what? Threatening parents. We'll either we'll send your kid to a school where he or she may contract a horrible disease and bring it home, or do without the school as a child care institution so you can't go to. I mean, the level of dysfunction that, for me, as I watch this, leaves me with one burning question, which I ask you, Seth, namely, why do the people of this country tolerate a system that works so badly?
I think the thing that I find sort of really disturbing, but also fascinating is I don't think that there is an awareness, broadly speaking, amongst the American public that there were choices that were involved here. That were choices, even put aside for a moment our current sort of political situation, because it's deadlocked and this and that. But there are choices that we make as a society that are ideological. Like, people think that it's just normal and there's an absence of ideology in the notion that we could go and pay a company and say, look, because we sort of did it, right? Like, the Paycheck Protection Program was like a real sort of like bank shot version of it. It was limited. It was cumbersome. We made it really difficult. We sort of do it when we pay people an extra $600 on the unemployment end. But again, that's cumbersome. It's got to go. We could have done this very directly. We could have spent, I don't know, maybe a little bit more money, maybe less. Who knows? But there is an ideological sort of block here that people, I don't even think most Americans realize, is an ideology. And that ideology is, and it's one that's not shared by any other country in the world. I mean, this idea that, like, because we're giving, I mean, talk a little bit about this, because I've interviewed many people there. ProPublica has a great piece on the implications of the CARES Act and how generous our government has been with corporations, but without any strings attached. And then so stingy with people. They did a great piece on Cleveland where they saw the disparity here between a corporation that received basically free money, essentially from the government, and then everybody else. And the results are obvious. But will you explain to people this dynamic? Because the Fed did something in the CARES Act. They were given money by Treasury, which basically was the backstop for a huge lending program that was unprecedented. Will you just explain that? Because we're doing this, folks, is the point. It's just that we're pretending we're not, so that people don't realize, like, we're doing it strictly for the benefit of one sector of our private economy and with no strings attached. And it basically, they're like a helium balloon flying up to the atmosphere while the rest of us are sort of like, you know, suffering from it.
I'd be glad to, and I'm glad you pointed it out. And I think historians will look back on this the way we look back on the tulip craze back in the 17th century, one of the great examples of a speculative boom that became a bubble that then burst and hurt a lot of people. And that's what this one is going to do, too. Here's how it basically works. The Treasury takes a portion of our tax payments and says we're setting it aside to be a kind of backstop for the Federal Reserve. That enables the Federal Reserve to create new money. That's very important to understand. Literally to create it, whether that takes the form of bills and the coins we carry in our pocket or electronic money, simply creates accounts at the Federal Reserve for private banks around the country to take that money for themselves. It can make loans many times larger because the assumption is we can lend $1 billion. The most we need in reserve is $100 million because we'll have the money coming in and out otherwise. That's a normal banking procedure. But it's important here to understand what the Fed then did. For the first time in its history, it began directly providing credit to corporations. limitlessly. And we're talking trillions of dollars. Here's how it works. Any company that has any problem, for example, what it produces has no market. People don't want it anymore. Or they're having a fight with their unions and they can't get their business going. Or their technology is badly out of date. Or whatever the problem. We have now created a situation where the quickest, easiest, and cheapest way to solve the problem is to get new money. Any corporation goes to a bank, says, give us a loan. Normally, the bank would have rules and regulations. But it doesn't anymore. Sure, it says, how much do you want? Why? Because the bank knows that within moments after giving the loan to, let's call it the ABC company, the bank turns around and sells that loan to the Federal Reserve. There it is. The Federal Reserve uses the fresh new money it created to buy the debts of private corporations. Having driven interest rates to next to nothing, the Fed has done that too, it's saying to a corporate America, here, we have all the money you need and the interest will be virtually nothing. So here it is. Solve your problems. You can't sell your goods? Don't go out of business. The Federal Reserve will backstop you. Go to any bank. The bank gets fees for all of this. So they make money even though they don't hold on to the loan. It's all very nicely greased for the banks to do it. They're doing it. Every corporation in America is borrowing money like there's no tomorrow under these circumstances. And the irony is, they're right. There is no tomorrow. You might as well borrow now because this ship is going down. That's the unspoken. And the people in the corporate America, they know what they're getting. They're getting their last chance. Here's all the money in the world. It costs you next to nothing. Do your best, man. Hope you make it, because the rest of the economy is hanging on whether you do or not.
And let's be clear. These corporations are made up of individuals who decide their compensation packages. So that's this isn't a situation where they're saying like, oh, we're going to use this to sort of make our businesses more durable. And I mean, maybe some are, but a lot of them are going, this is a good time for me to get a bonus.
Absolutely.
And so we're just increasing wealth inequality, and we're basically handing them money. And the average American, not even the average, the vast majority of Americans are not participating in this massive transfer of wealth.
That's right. And it's a holiday time. And it's I don't know what the numbers are, but it's somewhere between a quarter, I would guess around a quarter of American corporations are now in debt to the Federal Reserve. By the way, for your libertarian friends or for your conservative friends, let's be real clear. The private capitalist sector is now on life support credit from the Federal Reserve. The very idea that we have a private sector that's separate from the government sector is now officially a total fake, a total joke. The corporate sector is desperate. That's why any hint that interest rates might go up by Jerome Powell is a cause for alarm. The stock market takes a tank. The government is the only thing that keeps this broken system going, and it does so in the way the people at the top want. One last point. When you get a loan, if you're a company, you go to a bank, you get a loan. Let's be clear. The board of directors, that's about 12, 15 people in every corporation, they're the ones who decide what to do with the loan. And there's 800 easy ways to use it to pay dividends to shareholders, keep them happy, pay out a big fat pay packages to your top executives, have a big splurge in your PR department, give them a chunk so they can make it look like you're a big guardian of the environment or whatever game you're playing. I mean, we are being taken for a ride by a system that's going down. And with each passing day, it's up to those of us who see this, because it's our job, to say to the American people, you really have a choice here. Change the system or you're at risk of going down with it.
And people should just keep in mind here. I mean, the involvement of the government in the private economy is in and of itself not problematic, it seems to me. It is that it's simply it's going to such a narrow set of people that it is not durable, right? I mean, it's just like literally like if you're to build a house and you're to make it top heavy, it's going to tip over. And the bottom line is that if the government was basically giving money to workers to stay at home or to work only in a safe situation, the corporation is a pass-through in this instance. If they were doing that, you would have a lot happier, a lot less stressed individuals out there, and you would have a much wider base to the economy. It'd be far more durable going forward.
You know, you're absolutely right. They invented a phrase to justify giving the money to the top. And the phrase that came to stick was called trickle-down economics or trickle-down economic policy. Now, the idea was as simple as it sounds. You give money to the top, but it's okay because it will trickle down to everybody else. And the answer to that always was the facts, which is you gave an awful lot to the top and an awful little trickle down. That was the empirical critique. But a much better critique would be the one that has said, hey, if you give to the top and it doesn't trickle, you will have helped the people who need it least, and you will not have helped the people who need it most, and the ones who need it most are the majority. So that's a failed policy. So here's an alternative. Let's call it trickle up. You give money to the people at the bottom. They will then go into the stores and buy. That will produce profits for the corporations. And let's give it to the people at the bottom who need it most, who are the majority. And then let's hope it trickles up. And maybe it will and maybe it won't, but we'll be left with the majority of people helped. And that's more than what we're left with when you leave it at the level of trickle down.
Okay, so let me ask you this, and we just have a couple of minutes left. What, let's assume for a moment that Joe Biden wins the presidency. He gets in, and let's assume for the moment, because I'm feeling very optimistic these days, that the Democrats take the Senate and the House, and all the Democrats, all these new Democrats who come in, who may be a little bit more oriented towards, you know, the ideological perspective that government shouldn't be involved in these things unless it's just for corporations, right? They don't add that part of the phrase, but that's sort of like that's sort of understood at least amongst themselves. What would you do? Is there like I know there's no silver bullet, but what would you say is the number one priority? What would you start with that you think can make our economy more resilient, or at the very least, lessen the opportunity for people to be immiserated in these type of situations?
Well, you know, it's hard to do this in a short amount of time, but let me try. If you want an economic system to serve the people in general, then you got to put the people in general in charge. We have a hopeless effort in this country. We give a tiny group of people, the employers of this country, who, I'll be generous, are 3 or 4% of our people, our employers. All the rest are employees, right? If we give a tiny group like the employers the dominant position in every enterprise, every factory, every store, every office, a tiny group of people, the board of directors of a corporation, the owner of the enterprise, whatever we want to call it, this tiny group, we can't then be surprised that when you put them all together, they do what's best for them. So that's why they give out the profits as shareholder dividends, or they give out the profits as pay packages for the CEO. Why are we surprised by this? If we don't want these outcomes, if we don't want a handful of corporations handing out millions of dollars in donations to Republicans and Democrats, and therefore, of course, getting what they want, then we have to stop organizing our enterprises in the way that we have. And the alternative, we call, for lack of a better term, worker cooperatives. But the basic idea is to democratize the enterprise. If democracy is good where you live, Why the heck isn't it good where you work? Why don't we have the majority, one person, one vote, make the decisions in each workplace, what you're producing, how you're producing, where you're producing, and here comes the big one. What are you going to do with the profits your enterprise has generated that you all helped to produce? How are they going to be used? For what ends? If you want that discretionary profit, the surplus, to be used for the mass of people, you've got to make the mass of people make those decisions. And let me assure you, if you averaged it, if you took a decision as a worker co-op, democratically, how are we going to pay everybody? It wouldn't in a million years give five people millions of dollars while everybody else can't send their children to college. Wouldn't happen. That's not how democracy or majorities have ever worked. That would be a breakthrough. And if we just created a sector of the American economy, let's call it the worker co-op sector. You know, the province of Emilia-Romagna in Italy, 40% of enterprises, that's the area around Bologna in the north, 40% of enterprises there are worker co-ops. The people in that part of Italy can see what a worker co-op is, how it works. They actually have freedom of choice to work in a top-down capitalist enterprise or a democratic worker co-op. We don't have that choice in the United States because we don't have a sector that can let everybody know what kind of life it is if you work in a democratic co-op rather than a hierarchical capitalist enterprise. And I know these are fundamental changes, but our problems aren't little anymore, and we got to think a lot bigger or else we're going to miss this moment.
And just to be clear, my understanding is that at the very least there was a bill introduced, and it may have passed, but at one point there was a bill introduced by the Democrats to provide bridge loans to employees of family-owned companies that were going out of business or they wanted to sell it. And it would provide bridge loans to the employees who could then purchase the company from the family that owned it, so that the employees could take it over. And there it is. There's your workers' co-op. I mean, absolutely. So there are first of all, it's not that crazy of an idea. No. We have actually come very close to at least instituting it on some level. And we could easily have a government policy where we are providing just simply loans like we did to GM, like we're doing right now to all these corporations. Instead, we're going to employ it. We're going to offer these loans, these low cost loans to employees to buy their company. They can create their own board of directors from the employees, and run the company. I mean, look, I get my coffee from a co-op. It tastes, frankly, better than other coffees, but that's not necessarily the case. There may be other coffees that are better by a different co-op. I don't know. But the point is, none of this stuff is fantastical, and it all provides a lot more durability and sustainability for society.
You know, Sam, if you ever wanted to, I could sit down, we could have a conversation, and I would take you through the Spanish example, the most famous in the world, where they have these co-ops and have had them for decades. The examples in Italy and Germany, and then the examples here in the United States. There are a whole bunch of examples. There's a whole organization called the United States Federation of Worker Co-ops that brings a kind of collective exchange of information among the growing worker co-ops in this country. So yes, it's not a new idea. It's not a fantastical idea, but I believe because of the failure of the capitalist system we're living in, its historical time has now come.
Well, Professor Richard Wolff, the book is The Sickness is the System: When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. Folks can start with that book and read the, I think it's about 50 essays in there that cover a lot of this stuff. And, you know, I think there is a broad understanding in this country that our capitalist system is broken and we're going to be looking for ways to fix it regardless of who the president is. Well, we're going to have a much better shot, at the very least, of at least trying to get to the point where we try to fix it under Joe Biden. So hope springs eternal. We shall see. Professor Wolff, I will take you up on that, and we will do that interview on those co-ops again. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. Be glad to talk with you at any time.
Great. All right, folks. Got a couple of minutes left here in the program. We will put a link, obviously, to Professor Wolf's book on our website at majority.fm. I mean, look, Donald Trump is both a symptom, is both a problem and a symptom of a larger problem, and we're going to have to address it going forward. We have both parties failed in many respects to address sort of the broader problems. Certainly, the Republican Party is completely oriented towards helping exclusively these corporations. But if the Democratic Party is going to get serious about actually helping people, they both need to leverage the what they know Republicans want. We saw this in the context of the CARES Act. Speaker Pelosi was convinced in April of this year that we would get support for cities and for states, support for hospitals and schools. And I don't know if that was simply a misreading of what the Republican Party is. There was a lot of people who were concerned at the time. I think even Andrew Cuomo, who, again, I don't generally take advice from, was complaining about this back in April of this year. Nancy Pelosi was convinced. I don't know if she just underestimated, I should say, the complete disregard that the Republican Party holds the American public in, or it just wasn't as much of a priority as getting that money out the door for corporations. But people should understand this. This is an ideological choice. To simply say we're going to do things supposedly as we are. Now, it's unprecedented for the Fed to give money, to lend money directly to corporations. That's unprecedented. It hasn't happened before. And Jerome Powell, the chair of the Fed, says just today, the economy's resilience, to the extent that it exists, owes substantially to strong government support for households and businesses. The household support ended weeks ago. The business support keeps rolling on. But there's no rule or law that says, and there should be, if you're going to give the money, that those businesses have to care about their workers. There's no rule or law that says that businesses have to care about even their customers, or that they have to care about their communities. None of that exists. It could, but it doesn't. And understand, that is a choice. That's not just something that just happens. It's a choice that is being made by our policymakers. And it's a choice that we as Americans need to be aware of, so that in the future we could say, hey, we don't want you to make that choice. We want you to make the choice that says, pay workers, if you want to do it through corporations, do it through corporations. Pay workers before they lose their job, to be hired. And so that their companies can say, okay, 30% of you are coming in this week, 30% of you are coming in the next week, 30% of you are coming in the following week, 33%, 3 weeks. I'm just spitballing here, folks. And the way that we can afford to do that, the way that we can afford to be less productive but keep you safe, is because the government is paying us to pay you. So we're going to put an output out. We're going to produce what the market will bear, but we're going to do it in a safe way that is going to keep you safe, and it's going to keep you from, it's going to give you a lot less stress. And it will create less virus in the community, which will make it possible for your kids to go to school, maybe. That's the alternate vision for how this could have been handled. Now, Donald Trump was never going to do it, because they're just living on a, he's just living on a different planet. But the coronavirus is still going to be around if Donald Trump goes away. And so we're going to have another choice to make. It's a choice they've made in Europe, and largely been far more successful at this than we have. All right, that's it for the program today. We will be back tomorrow with more. Tomorrow night is the debate between Kamala Harris and Vice President Pence. We'll check that out. Thank you for joining us. As always, you can find out more at majority.fm. Was a pleasure. Now we head into the fun half, second hour, or maybe the second hour, second 90 minutes of our program. You can join us if you like, if you remember. In the meantime, say goodbye to our first hour viewers. And just a reminder, following this show, Nomiki Konst. Oh, wait, we're going to bring her on? Let's bring her on. We're still working on the, the show, the first hour of the show streams on the new Choice app on the inside the Peacock app. It's the Choice channel on the Peacock app. And you can check it out there. You can watch that first hour again on Peacock. They put different branding on it. Do we have the promo?
Yeah, we can pull that. Just give me a minute.
Yeah, let's pull the promo. So they put different branding on the show, which is fine. Still have the same backdrop, but different graphics, and it looks pretty cool. And you can check it out on that app every day, at least the first hour of the program. Nomi, where are you? She's still connecting. She is still connecting to the thing. Well, just a reminder, this show relies on your support. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. One of the things that we do on this program is we attempt to present views that are not available in the mainstream media. Now, one of the things that I really like about this sort of syndication deal, if you will, that we've made with this Choice channel on Peacock app is that I don't know how often Professor Wolf gets on NBC and has access to that audience, but he did today, and we got a big dose of what we should be doing, and hopefully we're going to do a lot more of that. Nomi, have you seen the new? Well, it's the same show, but it's on the Peacock app.
I have, and you're indoctrinating my parents, and I love it.
Well, I'm doing my best. That's one of the things I wanted to set out to do, is to indoctrinate your folks. I just want to play the promo. Because they have it's the same set, but different.
They mention socialism in it.
What are you going to do?
It's pretty amazing. With a communist.
People should understand that what we're talking about here is a party, not just Donald Trump. He can't do this without the party enabling him. I think Joe Biden is running the perfect Joe Biden campaign.
Well, context, it's okay.
Do you care at all about farm workers? Do you care at all about children? Do you care at all about climate change? You don't have to be a socialist or not a socialist to care about those things. In the history books, this is one of those touchstones that they use to sort of describe where people were at this point.
Look at that guy.
I don't feel like I've ever looked like that in my entire life.
Yeah, when has that been your posture?
Who is that?
I am almost like convinced that like they graft my, like, I think, I don't even know if any of that is me. Maybe it's just my hair on somebody else's body.
Where did they get the picture from? Do you know?
No, I think they took it here. I think they took it here. Like on that Friday, they came in, they took some pictures, but I don't ever remember standing like that. I don't ever remember looking like, I don't feel like I've ever looked like that in my entire life.
If I walked into the office and you were standing like that, I would be very suspicious.
It would be the way I would.
Maybe they photoshopped off your beard. Maybe that's what happened.
Matt comes in and I'm just trying to signal with my eyes. They're in the corner. They've got a weapon. Just shut up. It's a trap. It's a trap. Don't come in. It's a trap. It's a trap. It's a trap. Matt, go away. All right.
Oh my God.
Are we gonna let's just do we gotta go to the fun half.
So this is the part where we make fun of MSNBC? Is that how this works?
We go into the fun half and then we do that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
We should just tell people on today on your program, you got a great show at 3 p.m., correct?
We do. At 3 p.m., we have Jonathan Smucker, who is joining us to talk about a roadmap moving forward. He literally wrote a book on this a few years ago, and this is the time to think about how we use our power as a movement effectively. And then later, we have Napoleon DeLegend and Ken Klippenstein to just talk about, I can't even keep up. I keep adding stories to the news. So whatever's happening that hour is what we're going to talk about.
Yeah, folks, check it out. Matt, what's happening on TMBS tonight?
Yeah, we got Matt Karp, associate professor of history at Princeton, on to talk about SCOTUS going back to the 1860s and how we need to, you know, define it as an illegitimate institution again. And we also have Luke Mayville on to talk about how to win in rural areas and how not to win in rural areas with regards to expanding things like Medicaid. So that's tonight on patreon.com/TMBS.
And folks can check it. And Jamie was on your program on last Friday. Is that right? No, me?
On my show. Yeah, yeah. I was like, oh, on everybody's show? That's awesome. She was fantastic. Yes.
Folks should check that out as well. And just a reminder, this program has a longtime sponsor. Probably the longest sponsor we've ever had is a co-op. JustCoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee to your chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. And, you know, the only difference I think that you would see as a consumer, let's say, of from justcoffee.coop, well, you wouldn't see any. But the difference in terms of like what it is for your community, what it is, like, for instance, this program, I don't know if this program would be around right now if these guys were not a co-op.
Wow.
Because they were a co-op, because they were the ones who tipped me off to Cernovich sending out fake emails about trying to get me fired. And they would not have done that unless they were like movement people, unless they were like, you know, look, we don't have a board of directors who are going to say like, we're going to run away from that. They're people who have like opinions and don't have an agenda that is just about sort of extracting cash from it. You'd also know it if you were one of their suppliers, because there are times where some of these farms that they get their coffee from in Latin America, there's a drought, there's a hurricane, whatever it is. What these guys do is they say, we will still purchase whatever you have, and we will purchase from you in the future, and we promise we're going to stand by you. And if we have to figure out how to fill the gaps on our coffee supplies, we will do that. But we have a relationship with you, and that's what is paramount. I mean, that's the difference. That's the value of a co-op. All right. Going to take a quick break, head into the fun half of the program, 646-257-3920. We will take your phone calls and your IMs. See you in the fun half.
And for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Almost as what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back.
I am a total cunt.
Can we bring back DJ the Anarchy song, please?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ the Anarchy.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough of a break.
That's fucking nonsense.
Hey, fuck off! reminder.
I do not have Parkinson's.
And the alpha males are
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Almost says what?
What?
Almost says what?
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black. Africans, the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black.
Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them! Fuck them! Fuck them!
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are back, back. Africans are black.
Pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total
pussy.